The drive where you live are quite secure, is that correct? Answer, I hope so. Question, do you remember having a conversation with me when I tried to get into your fortress out there? Answer, I remember your insinuations or threats. Question, what were my insinuations or threats? Answer, that we will take care of you, Mr. Altabelli. We will see about you, Mr. Altabelli. We will get the court up at your house and have the trial at your house, Mr. Altabelli. Altabelli had told Kenrick that if the court ordered it, he would be glad to comply. Otherwise, no, it is a home. It is not going to be a tourist attraction or a freak show. Question, do you respect our courts of law, Mr. Altabelli? Answer, I think more than you, Mr. Kenrick. Despite defense objections, I had succeeded in getting in perhaps 95% of the testimony I'd hoped to elicit through Jacobson, Hatami, and Altabelli. With the next witness, I suddenly found myself in deep trouble. Charles Koenig took the stand to testify to finding Rosemary LaBianca's wallet in the women's restroom of the Standard Station in Sylmar where he worked. He described how, on lifting the top of the toilet tank, he'd seen the wallet wedged above the mechanism, just above the waterline. Kenrick cross-examined Koenig at great length about the toilet, causing more than a few snickers among spectators and press. Then I suddenly realized what he was getting at. Kenrick asked Koenig if there was a standard procedure in connection with servicing the toilets in the restroom. Koenig replied that the Standard Station operating manual required that the restroom be cleaned every hour. The bluing agent, which is kept in the tank of the toilet, Koenig further testified, had to be replaced whenever it ran out. How often was that? Kenrick asked. As lead man or boss of the station, Koenig had not personally cleaned the restrooms, but rather had delegated the task to others. Therefore, I was able to object to this and similar questions as calling for a conclusion on Koenig's part. Fortunately, court then recessed for the day. Immediately afterward, I called LAPD with an urgent request. I wanted the detectives to locate and interview every person who had worked in this particular station between August 10, 1969, the date Linda Kasabian testified she left the wallet there, and December 10, 1969. The date Koenig found it. And I wanted them interviewed before Kenrick could get to them, fearful that he might put words in their mouths. I told the officers, tell them, forget what the Standard Station operating manual says you should do. Forget, too, what your employer might say if he found you didn't follow the instructions to the letter. Just answer truthfully. Did you personally, at any time during your employment, change the bluing agent in that toilet? To replace the bluing agent, you had to lift the top off the tank. Had anyone done so, he would have immediately seen the wallet. If Kenrick could come up with just one employee who claimed to have replaced the bluing agent during that four-month period, the defense could forcefully contend that the wallet had been planted, not only destroying Linda Kasabian's credibility as to all of her testimony, but implying that the prosecution was trying to frame Manson. LAPD located some, but not all, of the former employees. None had ever changed the bluing agent. Fortunately, Kenrick apparently had no better luck. Hughes had only a few questions for Koenig, but they were devastating. Question. Now, Sylmar is predominantly a white area, is it not? Answer. Yeah, I guess so. Question. Sylmar is not a black ghetto, is it? Answer. No. According to Linda, Manson had wanted a black to find the wallet and use the credit cards, so blacks would be blamed for the murders. My whole theory of the motive was based on this premise. Why then had Manson left the wallet in a white area? In point of fact, the freeway exit Manson had taken was immediately north of Pacoima, the black ghetto of the San Fernando Valley. I tried to get this in through Koenig, but defense objections kept it out, and I later had to call Sergeant Patchett to so testify. With a single witness, a service station attendant, the defense, specifically Kenrick and Hughes, had almost knocked two huge holes in the prosecution's case. By now I had narrowed down my opponents. Fitzgerald made a good appearance, but rarely scored. Shin was likable. For his first trial, Hughes was doing damn well. But it was Irving Kenrick, whom most members of the press considered the trial's buffoon, who was scoring nearly all the points. Time and again, Kenrick succeeded in keeping out important evidence. For example, when Stephanie Schramm took the stand, Kenrick objected to her testimony regarding the murder school Manson had conducted at Barker Ranch, and Older sustained Kenrick's objection. Though I disagreed with Older's ruling, there was no way I could get around it. On direct, Stephanie had testified that she and Manson returned to Spawn Ranch from San Diego in a cream-colored van on the afternoon of Friday, August 8th. On cross-examination, Fitzgerald asked her, "Could you be mistaken one day?" This indicated to me that Manson might still be planning to go alibi, so on redirect I brought in the traffic ticket they had been given the previous day. With the August 8th arrest report on Brunner and Good, which contained the license number of the same van, I was now ready to demolish Charlie if the defense claimed he wasn't even in Southern California at the time of the murders. Yet I had no way of knowing whether Manson might have his own surprise bombshell, which he was waiting to explode. As it happened, he had. Sergeant Gutierrez on the helter-skelter door. Dwayne Wolfer on the sound tests he'd conducted at the Tate residence. Gerald Friedman on the last telephone call Stephen Parent made. Roseanne Walker on Atkins' remarks about the eyeglasses. Harold True on Manson's visits to the house next to the LaBianca residence. Sergeant McKellar on Krenwinkel's attempts to avoid recognition just prior to her arrest in Mobile, Alabama. Bits and pieces, but cumulative. And eventually, I hoped, convincing. Only a few prosecution witnesses remained, and I still didn't know what the defense would be. Although the prosecution had to give the defense a list of all our witnesses, the defense had no such obligation. Earlier, Fitzgerald had told the press that he intended to call 30 witnesses, among them such celebrities as Mama Cass, John Phillips, and Beatle John Lennon, the latter to testify as to how he interpreted his own song lyrics. But that, and the rumors that Manson himself planned to testify, were the only clues to the defense. And even Manson's testifying was an iffy thing. In my talks with Charlie, he seemed to vacillate. Maybe I'll testify. Maybe I won't. I continued to goad him, but was worried that perhaps I'd overplayed my hand. The defendants hadn't been in court since Manson's attack on the judge. The day Terry Melcher was to testify, however, Older permitted their return. Not wanting to face Manson, Terry asked me, "Can't I go back in the lockup and testify through the speaker?" Of all the prosecution witnesses, Melcher was the most frightened of Manson. His fear was so great, he told me, that he had been under psychiatric treatment and had employed a full-time bodyguard since December 1969. "Terry, they weren't after you that night," I tried to reassure him. "Manson knew you were no longer living there." Melcher was so nervous, however, that he had to be given a tranquilizer before taking the stand. Though he came over somewhat weaker than in our interviews, when he finished his testimony, he told me with evident relief that Manson had smiled at him, therefore he couldn't be too unhappy with what he'd said. Kenrick, probably at Manson's request, did not question Melcher. Hughes brought out that when Wilson and Manson drove Terry to the gate of 10,050 Cielo Drive that night, they probably saw him push the button. The defense could now argue that if Manson was familiar with the gate operating device, it would be unlikely he'd have the killers climb over the fence, as Linda claimed they had. By this time I had proof that both Watson and Manson had been to 10,050 Cielo Drive on a number of occasions before the murders. But the jury would never hear it. Some months earlier I'd learned that after Terry Melcher had moved out of the residence, but before the Polanskis had moved in, Greg Jacobson had arranged for a Dean Morehouse to stay there for a brief period. During this time, Tex Watson had visited Morehouse at least 3 and possibly as many as 6 times. In a private conversation with Fitzgerald, I told him this, and he replied that he already knew it. Though I intended to introduce this evidence during the Watson trial, I didn't want to bring it in during the current proceedings, and I was hoping that Fitzgerald wouldn't either, since it emphasized the Watson rather than the Manson link. Though I suspected that Manson had visited there also during the same period, I had no proof of this until the trial was well underway, when I learned from the best possible source that Manson had been to 10,050 Cielo Drive on 5 or 6 occasions. My source was Manson himself, who admitted this to me during one of our rap sessions. Manson denied, however, having been in the house itself. He and Tex went up there, he said, to race dune buggies up and down the hills. But I couldn't use this information against Manson, because, as he well knew, all of my conversations with him were at his instance, and he was never advised of his constitutional rights. It was a decidedly curious situation. Although Manson had vowed to kill me, he still asked to see me periodically, to rap. Equally curious were our conversations. Manson told me, for example, that he personally believed in law and order. There should be rigid control by the authorities, he said. It didn't matter what the law was, right and wrong being relative, but it should be strictly enforced by whoever had the power. And public opinion should be suppressed, because part of the people wanted one thing, part another. In other words, your solution would be a dictatorship, I remarked. Yes. He had a simple solution to the crime problem, Manson told me. Empty the prisons and banish all the criminals to the desert. But first brand their foreheads with X's, so if they ever appeared in the cities, they could be identified and shot on sight. Do I need 2 guesses as to who's going to be in charge of them in the desert, Charlie? No. He grinned. On another occasion, Manson told me that he had just written to President Nixon, asking him to turn over the reins of power to him. If I was interested, I could be his vice president. I was a brilliant prosecutor, he said, a master with words, and you're right on about a lot of things. What things, Charlie? Helter-skelter, the way the murders came down, your philosophy on life and death? Manson smiled and declined to answer. We both know you ordered these murders, I told him.
Bugliosi, it's the Beatles, the music they're putting out. They're talking about war.
These kids listen to this music and pick up the message. It's subliminal. You were along on the night of the LaBianca murders.
I went out a lot of nights.
Never a direct denial. I couldn't wait to get him on the stand. Manson told me that he liked prison, though he liked the desert, the sun, and women better. I told him he'd never been inside the green room at San Quentin before. He wasn't afraid of death, Manson responded. Death was only a thought. He'd faced death before many times, in both this and past lives. I asked him if, when he shot Crow, he'd intended to kill him. Sure, he replied, adding, I could kill everyone without blinking an eye. When I asked why, he said, because you've been killing me for years. Pressed as to whether all this killing bothered him, Manson replied that he had no conscience, that everything was only a thought. Only he, and he alone, was on top of his thought, in complete control, unprogrammed by any one or anything. When it comes down around your ears, you'd better believe I'll be on top of my thought, Manson said. I will know what I am doing. I will know exactly what I am doing. Manson frequently interrupted the testimony of Brooks Poston and Paul Watkins with asides. Kenrick's interruptions were so continuous that Older, calling him to the bench angrily, told him, "You are trying to disrupt the testimony with frivolous, lengthy, involved, silly objections. You have done it time and again during this trial. I have studied you very carefully, Mr. Kenrick. I know exactly what you were doing. I have had to find you in contempt twice before for doing the same thing. I won't hesitate to do it again."
It was all too obvious to both Kenrick and Manson that Poston and Watkins were impressively strong witnesses. Step by step, they traced the evolution of Helter Skelter, not intellectually as Jacobson understood it, but as one-time true believers, members of the family who had watched a vague concept slowly materialize into terrifying reality. The cross-examination didn't shake their testimony in the slightest. Rather, it elicited more details. When Kenrick questioned Poston, for example, he accidentally brought out a good domination example. When Charlie would be around, things would be like when a schoolteacher comes back to class. Hughes asked Poston, "Did you feel you were under Mr. Manson's hypnotic spell?" Answer, "No, I did not think that Charlie had a hypnotic spell." Question, "Did you feel he had some power?" Answer, "I felt he was Jesus Christ. That is power enough for me." Looking back on his time with Manson, Poston said, "I learned a lot from Charlie, but it doesn't seem that he was making all those people free." Watkins observed, "Charlie was always preaching love. Charlie had no idea what love was. Charlie was so far from love it wasn't even funny. Death is Charlie's trip. It really is." Since his extradition to California, Charles Tex Watson had been behaving peculiarly. At first he spoke little, then stopped speaking entirely. The prisoners in his cell block signed a petition complaining of the unsanitary condition of his cell. For hours he'd stare off into space, then inexplicably hurl himself against his cell wall. Placed in restraints, he stopped eating, and even though force-fed, his weight dropped to 110 pounds. Though there was evidence that he was faking at least part of his symptoms, his attorney, Sam Bubrick, asked the court to appoint three psychiatrists to examine him. Their conclusions differed, but they agreed on one point. Watson was rapidly reverting to a fetal state, which, unless immediately treated, could be fatal. Acting on the basis of their examination, on October 29th, Judge Dell ruled Watson was at present incompetent to stand trial and ordered him committed to Atascadero State Hospital. Manson asked to see me during the recess. "Vince," Manson pleaded through the lockup door, "give me just half an hour with Tex. I'm positive I can cure him." "I'm sorry, Charlie," I told him. "I can't afford to take that chance. If you cured him, then everyone would believe you were Jesus Christ." November 1st to 19th, 1970. The day before Watson was committed to Atascadero, two court-appointed psychiatrists found 17-year-old Diane Lake competent to testify. Following her release from Patton, Diane had received some good news. Inyo County investigator Jack Gardner and his wife, who had befriended Diane after her arrest in the Barker raid, had been appointed her foster parents. She would live with them and their children until she finished high school. Because of Aranda, there were some things the jury never heard. For example, that Tex had told Leslie to stab Rosemary LaBianca and later to wipe fingerprints off everything they had touched, since Katie had related these things to Diane, and any reference by Katie to her co-defendants had to be excised. Diane could testify to what Leslie had told her she had done. However, the problem here was that Leslie never told Diane whom she had stabbed. She said she had stabbed someone who was already dead, that this occurred near Griffith Park, and that there was a boat outside. From these facts, I hoped the jury would conclude that she was talking about the LaBiancas. Diane also testified that one morning in August, Leslie had come into the back house at Spawn and proceeded to burn a purse, a credit card, and her own clothing, keeping only a sack of coins, which the girls divided and spent on food. Diane, however, was unable to pinpoint the exact date, and though I hoped the jury would surmise this had occurred the morning after the LaBiancas were killed, there was no proof that this was so. Since this was the only evidence, independent of Linda Kasabian's testimony, which I had linking Leslie Van Houten to the LaBianca homicides, it hurt, and badly,
When Hughes on Cross brought out that Diane wasn't sure whether Leslie had told her about the boat or whether she had read about it in the newspapers. Hughes also focused on a number of minor discrepancies in her previous statements. She'd told Sartucci the coins were in the purse, while she'd told me they were in a plastic bag, and what could have been one very big bombshell. On direct, Diane had said that she, Little Patty, and Sandra Good, I believe, had divided the money. If Sandy was present, this couldn't have been August 10th, the morning after the LaBianca murders, since Sandra Good, along with Mary Brunner, was still in custody. However, questioned further, Diane said Sandy might not have been there. In his cross-examination, Kenrick brought out that Sergeant Gutierrez had threatened Diane with the gas chamber. Fitzgerald also came up with a prior inconsistent statement. Diane had told the grand jury that she was in Inyo County rather than at Spawn Ranch on August 8th and 9th. On redirect, I asked Diane, "Why did you lie to the grand jury?" Answer, "Because I was afraid that I would be killed by members of the family if I told the truth. And Charlie asked me not to. He told me not to say anything to anybody who had the power of authority." On November 4th, Sergeant Gutierrez, in search of a cup of coffee, had wandered into the jury room where the female defendants stayed during recesses. He found a yellow legal pad with the name Patricia Krenwinkel on it. Among the notes and doodlings, Katie had written the words Helter Skelter three times, misspelling that first word exactly the same way it had been misspelled on the LaBianca refrigerator door. Older would not permit me to introduce it in evidence, however. I felt he was 100% wrong about this. It was unquestionably circumstantial evidence. It had relevance, and it was admissible. But Older ruled otherwise. Older also gave me a scare when I attempted to introduce Krenwinkel's refusal to make a printing exemplar. Older agreed it was admissible, but he felt Krenwinkel should be given another chance to comply, and ordered her to do so. The problem here was that this time Krenwinkel just might, on the advice of counsel, make the exemplar, and if she did, I knew there would be real problems. Katie refused, on the instructions of Paul Fitzgerald. What Fitzgerald apparently did not realize was that it would be extremely difficult, if not impossible, for LAPD to match the two printing samples. And had LAPD failed to do so, by law Patricia Krenwinkel would have to be acquitted of the LaBianca murders. Her refusal to give an exemplar was the only speck of independent evidence I had supporting Kasabian's testimony regarding Krenwinkel's involvement in these crimes. Krenwinkel had been given an excellent chance to beat the rap. To this day, I still don't understand why her attorney instructed her as he did, and so lost her that chance. The people's last two witnesses, Doctors Blake Skirdla and Harold Deering, were the psychiatrists who had examined Diane. On both direct and redirect examination, I elicited testimony from them to the effect that, although a powerful drug, LSD does not impair memory, nor is there any demonstrable medical evidence that it causes brain damage. This was important, since the defense attorneys had contended that the minds of various prosecution witnesses, in particular Linda and Diane, had been so blown by LSD that they could not distinguish fantasy from reality. Skirdla testified that people on LSD can tell the difference between the real and the unreal. In fact, they often have a heightened awareness. Skirdla further stated that LSD causes illusions rather than hallucinations. In other words, that which is seen is actually there, only the perception of it is changed. This surprised a lot of people, since LSD is called a hallucinogenic drug. When Watkins was on the stand, I personally brought out that although he was only 20, Paul had taken LSD between 150 and 200 times. Yet, as the jury undoubtedly observed, he was one of the brightest and most articulate of the prosecution witnesses. Skirdla also testified, "I have seen individuals who have taken it several hundred times and show no outward sign of any emotional disturbance while they are not on the drug." Fitzgerald asked Skirdla, would LSD in large doses over a period of time make someone sort of a zombie, or would it destroy rational thought processes? If, as I suspected, Fitzgerald was trying to lay the foundation for a defense based on this premise, that foundation collapsed when Skirdla replied, I have not seen this, Council. Dr. Deering was the people's last witness. He finished testifying on Friday, November 13th. Most of Monday, the 16th, was spent introducing the people's exhibits into evidence. There were 320 of these, and Kenrick objected to every one, from the gun to the scale map of the Tate premises. His strongest objections were to the color death photos. Responding, I argued, I grant the court that these photographs are gruesome, there is no question about it, but if, in fact, the defendants are the ones who committed these murders, which the prosecution, of course, is alleging, they are the ones who were responsible for the gruesomeness and the ghastliness. It is their handiwork. The jury is entitled to look at that handiwork. Judge Older agreed, and they were admitted into evidence. One exhibit never made it into evidence. As mentioned earlier, a number of white dog hairs had been found on the discarded clothing the killers wore the night of the Tate murders. Shown them, Winifred Chapman told me they looked like the hair of Sharon's dog. When I requested that they be brought over from LAPD, however, I got only excuses. Finally, I learned that while walking across the street to the Hall of Justice, one of the Tate detectives had dropped and broken the vial containing the hairs. He had been able to recover only one. Realizing that the expression grasping at hairs would be all too appropriate in this case, I decided against introducing that single hair into evidence. At 4:27 p.m. that Monday, exactly 22 weeks after the start of the trial, and 2 days short of a year after my assignment to the case, I told the court, Your Honor, the people of the state of California rest. Court was recessed until Thursday, November 19th, at which time each of the defense attorneys argued the standard motions to dismiss. Back in December 1969, a great many attorneys predicted that when we reached this point, Manson would have to be acquitted because of insufficiency of evidence. I doubted if any lawyer in the country felt that way now, including the attorneys for the defense. Older denied all the motions. The court, are you ready to proceed with the defense? Fitzgerald, yes, Your Honor. The court, you may call your first witness, Mr. Fitzgerald. Fitzgerald, thank you, Your Honor. The defendants rest. Nearly everyone in the courtroom was caught completely off guard. For several seconds, even Judge Older seemed too stunned to speak. The ultimate legal issue at a criminal trial is not the defendant's guilt or innocence, as most people believe. The issue is whether or not the prosecution has met its legal burden of proving the guilt of the defendant beyond a reasonable doubt and to a moral certainty. In American criminal jurisprudence, the term not guilty is not totally synonymous with innocence. Not guilty is a legal finding by the jury that the prosecution hasn't proven its case. A not guilty verdict based on the insufficiency of the evidence can result from either of two states of mind on the part of the jury, that they believe the defendant is innocent and did not commit the crime charged, or, although they tend to believe he did commit the crime, the prosecution's case was not sufficiently strong to convince them of his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt and to a moral certainty. The defense obviously, but unexpectedly, had decided to avoid cross-examination and to rely on the argument that we hadn't proved the guilt of Manson and his co-defendants beyond a reasonable doubt, and hence, they were entitled to not guilty verdicts. The biggest surprise, however, was still to come. Part 7. Murder in the Wind. You could feel something in the air, you know. You could feel something in the air. Juan Flynn. Snitches and other enemies will be taken care of. Sandra Good. Before his disappearance, Ronald Hughes, the missing defense attorney in the Tate-LaBianca murder trial, confided to close friends that he was in fear of Manson. Los Angeles Times. November 19th to December 20th, 1970. Fitzgerald said the defense had rested, but the three female defendants now shouted that they wanted to testify. Calling counsel into chambers, Judge Older demanded to know exactly what was going on. There had been a split between the defense attorneys and their clients, Fitzgerald said. The girls wanted to testify. Their attorneys opposed this and wanted to rest their case. Only after an hour of intense discussion did the real reason for the split come out in an off-the-record admission by Fitzgerald. Sadie, Katie, and Leslie wanted to take the stand and testify that they had planned and committed the murders and that Manson was not involved. Charlie had tried to explode his bombshell, but the attorneys for the girls had managed to defuse it, at least temporarily. Standing up against Manson for the first time, Ronald Hughes observed, "I refuse to take part in any proceeding where I am forced to push a client out the window." The legal problems thus created were immense, but basically they came down to the question of which took precedence, the right to effective counsel or the right to testify. Worried that whichever course Older took might be reversible error on appeal, I suggested he take the matter to the state Supreme Court for a decision. Older, however, decided that even though the attorneys had rested and had advised their clients not to take the stand, the right to testify supersedes any and all other rights. The girls would be permitted to take the stand. Older asked Manson if he also wished to testify. "No," he replied. Then after a moment's hesitation, added, "That is, not at this time, anyway." On returning to open court, Kenrick made a motion to sever Manson so he could be tried separately. Charlie was now attempting to abandon ship while letting the girls sink. After denying the motion, Older had the jury brought in, and Susan Atkins took the stand and was sworn. Day Shin, however, refused to question her, stating that if he asked the questions she'd prepared, they would incriminate her. Shin's remarks, in themselves incriminating, were later stricken from the record. This created a whole new problem. Returning to chambers, Older remarked, "It is becoming perfectly clear that this entire maneuver by the defense is simply one to wreck the trial. I do not intend to permit this to happen." Still in chambers and outside the presence of the jury, Susan Atkins told Judge Older that she wanted to testify to the way it happened. The way I saw it happen. The court. "You are subjecting yourself to the extreme risk of convicting yourself out of your own mouth. Do you understand that?" Atkins. "I understand that." She added that if she was convicted, let them convict me on the truth. I do not wish to be convicted on a pack of lies taken out of context and just scattered every which way. Because, Mr. Bugliosi, your foundation is just crumbling. I have watched it crumble. You have been a sly, sneaky fox." Bugliosi. "Why do you want to put it back together for me, Sadie, if it is crumbling? You should be happy. You can go back to Barker Ranch if it is crumbling. Why do you want to take the stand to help me?" Shin said he would ask to be relieved as counsel if Older ordered him to question his client. Fitzgerald replied similarly, adding, "As far as I am concerned, it would be sort of aiding and abetting a suicide." The matter was unresolved when court recessed for the day. The following day, Manson surprised everyone by saying that he, too, wanted to testify. In fact, he wanted to go on the stand before the others. Because of possible Aranda problems, however, it was decided that Manson should first testify outside the presence of the jury. Manson was sworn. Rather than have Kenrick question him, he requested and received permission to make a statement. He spoke for over an hour. He began almost apologetically, at first speaking so low that the spectators in the crowded courtroom had to lean forward to hear. But after a few minutes, the voice changed, grew stronger, more animated, and as I'd already discovered in my conversations with him, when this happened, his face seemed to change too. Manson, the nobody, Manson the martyr, Manson the teacher, Manson the prophet. He became all these and more, the metamorphosis often occurring in mid-sentence, his face a light show of shifting emotions until it was not one face, but a kaleidoscope of different faces, each real, but only for the moment. He rambled, he digressed, he repeated himself, but there was something hypnotic about the whole performance. In his own strange way, he was trying to weave a spell, not unlike the ones he had cast over his impressionable followers. Manson, there has been a lot of charges and a lot of things said about me and brought against the co-defendants in this case, of which a lot could be cleared up and clarified. I never went to school, so I never growed up to read and write too good, so I have stayed in jail, and I have stayed stupid, and I have stayed a child while I have watched your world grow up, and then I look at the things that you do, and I don't understand. You eat meat, and you kill things that are better than you are, and then you say how bad and even killers your children are. You made your children what they are. These children that come at you with knives, they are your children. You taught them. I didn't teach them. I just tried to help them stand up. Most of the people at the ranch that you call the family were just people that you did not want. People that were alongside the road, that their parents had kicked out, that did not want to go to juvenile hall. So I did the best I could, and I took them up on my garbage dump, and I told them this, that in love there is no wrong. I told them that anything they do for their brothers and sisters is good if they do it with a good thought. I was working at cleaning up my house, something that Nixon should have been doing. He should have been on the side of the road picking up his children, but he wasn't. He was in the White House, sending them off to war. I don't understand you, but I don't try. I don't try to judge nobody. I know that the only person I can judge is me, but I know this, that in your hearts and your own souls you are as much responsible for the Vietnam War as I am for killing these people. I can't judge any of you. I have no malice against you and no ribbons for you, but I think that it is high time that you all start looking at yourselves and judging the lie that you live in. I can't dislike you, but I will say this to you. You haven't got long before you are all going to kill yourselves because you are all crazy, and you can project it back at me, but I am only what lives inside each and every one of you. My father is in the jailhouse. My father is your system. I am only what you made me. I am only a reflection of you. I have ate out of your garbage cans to stay out of jail. I have wore your second-hand clothes. I have done my best to get along in your world, and now you want to kill me, and I look at you, and then I say to myself, you want to kill me? Ha! I'm already dead, have been all my life. I've spent 23 years in tombs that you built. Sometimes I think about giving it back to you. Sometimes I think about just jumping on you and letting you shoot me. If I could, I would jerk this microphone off and beat your brains out with it, because that is what you deserve. That is what you deserve. If I could get angry at you, I would try to kill every one of you. If that's guilt, I accept it. These children, everything they done for the love of their brother. If I showed them that I would do anything for my brother, including giving my life for my brother on the battlefield, and then they pick up their banner, and they go off and do what they do, that is not my responsibility. I don't tell people what to do. These children, indicating the female defendants, were finding themselves. What they did, if they did whatever they did, is up to them. They will have to explain that to you. It's all your fear. You look for something to project it on, and you pick out a little old scroungy nobody that eats out of a garbage can, and that nobody wants, that was kicked out of the penitentiary, that has been dragged through every hellhole that you can think of, and you drag him and put him in a courtroom. You expect to break me? Impossible. You broke me years ago.
You killed me years ago.
Older asked Manson if he had anything further to say. Manson,
I have killed no one, and I have ordered no one to be killed. I may have implied on several different occasions to several different people that I may have been Jesus Christ, but I haven't decided yet what I am or who I am.
Some called him Christ, Manson said. In prison, his name was a number. Some now want a sadistic fiend, and so they see him as that. So be it. Guilty? Not guilty. They are only words. You can do anything you want with me, but you cannot touch me because I am only my love. If you put me in the penitentiary, that means nothing because you kicked me out of the last one. I didn't ask to get released. I liked it in there because I like myself.
Telling Manson, you seem to be getting far afield, Older asked him to stick to the issues.
Manson, the issues?
Mr. Bugliosi is a hard-driving prosecutor, polished education, a master of words, semantics. He is a genius. He has got everything that every lawyer would want to have except one thing, a case.
He doesn't have a case. Were I allowed to defend myself, I could have proven this to you. The evidence in this case is a gun. There was a gun that laid around the ranch. It belonged to everybody. Anybody could have picked that gun up and done anything they wanted to do with it. I don't deny having that gun. That gun has been in my possession many times. Like the rope was there.
Sure, he'd bought the rope, Manson admitted, 150 feet of it, because you need rope on a ranch.
The clothes? It is really convenient that Mr. Baggett found those clothes. I imagine he got a little taste of money for that.
The bloodstains?
Well, they are not exactly bloodstains. They are benzidine reaction.
The leather thong?
How many people have ever worn moccasins with leather thongs?
The photos of the 7 bodies, 169 stab wounds.
They put the hideous bodies on display and they imply, if he gets out, see what will happen to you.
Helter-skelter?
It means confusion, literally. It doesn't mean any war with anyone. It doesn't mean that some people are going to kill other people. Helter-skelter is confusion. Confusion is coming down around you fast. If you can't see the confusion coming down around you fast, you can call it what you wish.
Conspiracy.
Is it a conspiracy that the music is telling the youth to rise up against the establishment because the establishment is rapidly destroying things? Is that a conspiracy?
The music speaks to you every day, but you were too deaf, dumb, and blind to even listen to the music.
It is not my conspiracy. It is not my music. I hear what it relates. It says rise. It says kill.
Why blame it on me? I didn't write the music.
About the witnesses.
For example, Danny DiCarlo. He said that I hate black men, and he said that we thought alike. But actually all I ever did with Danny DiCarlo or any other human being was reflect him back at himself. If he said he did not like the black man, I would say, okay. So consequently, he would drink another beer and walk off and say, Charlie thinks like I do. But actually, he does not know how Charlie thinks, because Charlie has never projected himself. I don't think like you people. You people put importance on your lives. Well, my life has never been important to anyone.
Linda Kasabian. She only testified against him because she saw him as her father, and she never liked her father. So she gets on the stand, and she says when she looked in that man's eyes that was dying, she knew that it was my fault. She knew it was my fault because she couldn't face death. And if she can't face death, that is not my fault. I can face death. I have all the time. In the penitentiary, you live with it, with constant fear of death, because it is a violent world in there, and you have to be on your toes constantly.
Diane Lake. She wanted attention. She would make trouble, cause accidents to get it. She wanted a father to punish her. So as any father would do,
I conditioned her mind with pain to keep her from burning the ranch down. Yes, he was a father to the young girls and boys in the family, but a father only in the sense that he taught them not to be weak and not to lean on me. Paul Watkins wanted a father. I told him, to be a man, boy, you have to stand up and be your own father. So he goes off to the desert and finds a father image in Paul Crockett. Yes, he put a knife to Juan Flynn's throat. Yes, he told him he felt responsible for all of these killings. I do feel some responsibility. I feel a responsibility for the pollution. I feel a responsibility for the whole thing. He didn't deny that he had told Brooks Poston to get a knife and go kill the sheriff of Shoshone. I don't know the sheriff of Shoshone. I am not saying that I didn't say it, but if I said it, at the time I may have thought it was a good idea. To be honest with you, I don't recall ever saying get a knife and a change of clothes and go do what Tex says. Or I don't recall saying get a knife and go kill the sheriff. In fact, it makes me mad when someone kills snakes or dogs or cats or horses. I don't even like to eat meat. That is how much I am against killing. I haven't got any guilt about anything because I have never been able to see any wrong. I have always said, do what your love tells you, and I do what my love tells me. Is it my fault that your children do what you do? What about your children? Manson asked angrily, rising slightly in the witness chair as if he were about to spring forward and attack everyone in the courtroom. You say there are just a few? There are many, many more coming in the same direction. They are running in the streets, and they are coming right at you. I had only a few questions for Manson, none of which came from the notebooks I kept. Question. You say you were already dead, is that right, Charlie? Answer. Dead in your mind, or dead in my mind? Question. Define it any way you want to. Answer. As any child will tell you, dead is when you are no more. It is just when you were not there. If you weren't there, you would be dead. Question. How long have you been dead? Manson evaded a direct reply. Question. To be precise about it, you think you have been dead for close to 2,000 years, don't you? Answer. Mr. Bugliosi, 2,000 years is relative to the second we live in. Question. Suffice it to say, Department 104 is a long way from Calvary, isn't that true? Manson had testified that all he wanted was to take his children and return to the desert. After I reminded him that the only people who can set you free so that you can go back to the desert are the 12 jurors in this case, and noting that though he had testified for over an hour, the jury in this case never heard a single solitary word you said, I posed one final question. Mr. Manson, are you willing to testify in front of the jury and tell them the same things that you have testified to here in open court today? Kenrick objected. Older sustained the objection, and I concluded my cross. To my surprise, Older later asked me why I hadn't seriously cross-examined Manson. I'd thought the reason was obvious. I had nothing to gain, since the jury wasn't present. I had lots and lots of questions for Charlie, several notebooks full, if he took the stand in the presence of the jury, but in the meantime I had no intention of giving him a dry run. However, when Older asked Manson if he now wished to testify before the jury, Charlie responded, I have already relieved all the pressure I had. As Manson left the stand and passed the counsel table, I overheard him tell the three girls, you don't have to testify now. The big question, what did he mean by now? I strongly suspected that Manson hadn't given up, but was only biding his time. After the defense had introduced their exhibits, Judge Older recessed court for 10 days to give the attorneys time to prepare their jury instructions and arguments. This being his first trial,
Ron Hughes had never argued before a jury before, or participated in drawing up the instructions which the judge would give the jury just before they began their deliberations. He was obviously looking forward to it, however. He confided to TV newscaster Stan Atkinson that he was convinced he could win an acquittal for Leslie Van Houten. He wouldn't even get the chance to try. When court resumed on Monday, November 30th, Ronald Hughes was absent. Quizzed by Older, none of the other defense attorneys knew where he was. Fitzgerald said that he had last talked to Ron on Thursday or Friday, and that he sounded okay at that time. Hughes often spent his weekends camping at Sespe Hot Springs, a rugged terrain some 130 miles northwest of Los Angeles. There had been floods in the area the past weekend. It was possible that Hughes had been stranded there. The next day we learned that Hughes had gone to Sespe on Friday with two teenagers, James Forsher and Lauren Elder, in Miss Elder's Volkswagen. The pair, who were questioned but not held, said that when it began raining they had decided to return to L.A., but Hughes had decided to stay over until Sunday. When the two tried to leave, however, their auto became mired down, and they were forced to abandon it and hike out. Three other youths had seen Hughes on the morning of the following day, Saturday the 28th. He was alone at the time and on high ground, well away from the flood area. Chatting with them briefly, he appeared neither ill nor in any danger. Polygraphed, the three were found to have no additional knowledge, and they were not held. Since Forsher and Elder had last seen Hughes a day earlier, they apparently were not polygraphed, and their story was taken at face value. Owing to the continued bad weather, it was 2 days before the Ventura Sheriff's Office could get up a helicopter to search the area. In the meantime, rumors abounded. One was to the effect that Hughes had deliberately skipped, either to avoid argument or to sabotage the trial. Knowing Ron, I seriously doubted if this was true. I became convinced it wasn't when reporters visited the place where Hughes lived. He slept on a mattress in a garage behind the home of a friend. According to reporters, the place was a mess. One remarked that he wouldn't even let his dog sleep there. But on the wall of the garage, neatly framed and carefully hung, was Ronald Hughes' bar certificate. Although there were numerous reports that a man fitting Hughes' description had been seen in various places, boarding a bus in Reno, driving on the San Bernardino Freeway, drinking at a bar in Baja, none checked out. On December 2nd, Judge Older told Leslie Van Houten that he felt a co-counsel should be brought in to represent her during Hughes' absence. Leslie said she would refuse any other attorney. On December 3rd, after consulting with Paul Fitzgerald, Older appointed Maxwell Keith co-counsel for Leslie. A quiet, somewhat shy man in his mid-40s, whose conservative clothing and courtroom manner were in sharp contrast to those of Hughes, Keith had an excellent reputation in the legal community. Those who knew him well described him as conscientious, totally ethical, and completely professional, and it was clear from the start that he would be representing his client and not Manson. Sensing this, Manson asked to have all the defense attorneys dismissed. "They aren't our lawyers. They won't listen to us," so he and the girls could represent themselves. He also demanded that the case be reopened so they could put on a defense. They had 21 witnesses waiting to testify, he said. Both requests were denied. Keith had his work laid out for him. Before he could prepare his argument, he had to familiarize himself with 152 volumes of transcript, over 18,000 pages. Though Older granted a delay until he could do so, he told all counsel, "We will continue to meet every day at 9 a.m. until further notice." Older obviously wanted to count heads. Several days earlier, Steve Kay had overheard Manson tell the girls, "Watch Paul. I think he's up to something." I made sure Fitzgerald learned of the conversation. One missing attorney was more than enough. Neither the air search nor a subsequent ground search of the Sespe area yielded any trace of Hughes.
The abandoned Volkswagen was found with a batch of court transcripts inside, but other papers Hughes was known to have had, including a secret psychiatric report on Leslie Van Houten, were missing. On December 6th, Paul Fitzgerald told reporters, "I think Ron is dead." On December 7th, an all-points bulletin was issued for Hughes, LASO admitting, "This is something you do when you have no other leads." On December 8th, Judge Older went to the Ambassador Hotel to inform the jury of the reason for the delay. He also told them, "It appears fairly certain that you will be sequestered over the Christmas holidays." They took it much better than expected. On December 12th, the search for Ronald Hughes was suspended. The most persistent rumor was that Hughes had been murdered by the family. There was, at this time, no evidence of this, but there was more than ample cause for speculation. Though once little more than an errand boy for Manson, during the course of the trial, Hughes had grown increasingly independent, until the two had finally split over whether there should be a defense, Hughes strongly opposing his clients taking the stand to absolve Charlie. I also heard from several sources, including Paul Fitzgerald, that Hughes was afraid of Manson. It was possible that he showed this fear, which, in Manson's case, was like waving a red flag before a bull. Fear turned Charlie on. There could have been several reasons for his murder, if it was that. It may have been done to intimidate the other defense attorneys into letting Manson put on a defense during the penalty trial. One was so shaken by Hughes' disappearance that he went on a bender which ended in his arrest for drunken driving. Equally likely, it could have been a tactic to delay the trial, with the hope that it would result in a mistrial or set the stage for a reversal on appeal. Speculation, nothing more. Except for one odd, perhaps unrelated incident. On December 2nd, 4 days after Hughes was last seen alive, fugitives Bruce Davis and Nancy Pittman, a.k.a. Brenda McCann, voluntarily surrendered to the police. Two of the family's most hardcore members, Pittman had been missing for several weeks after failing to appear for sentencing on a forgery charge, while Davis, who had been involved in both the Hinman and Shea murders, who had picked up the gun with which Zero had committed suicide but had somehow left no prints, and who was the chief suspect in the slaying of two young Scientology students, these murders will be discussed in a later chapter, had evaded capture for over 7 months. Maybe it was just the proximity in time that linked the two events in my mind. Hughes' disappearance, Davis and Pittman's surprise surrender. But I couldn't shake the feeling that in some way the two incidents might be related. On December 18th, 3 days before the Tate-LaBianca trial reconvened, the Los Angeles County Grand Jury indicted Steve Grogan, a.k.a. Clem, Lynette Frome, a.k.a. Squeaky, Ruth Ann Morehouse, a.k.a. Uish, Catherine Scher, a.k.a. Gypsy, and Dennis Rice on charges of conspiracy to prevent and dissuade a witness, Barbara Hoyt, from attending a trial. Three other charges, including conspiracy to commit murder, were dismissed by Judge Choate on a 995 motion by the defense. Although we had presumed, as I suspected the involved family members had also, that an overdose of LSD could be fatal, we learned from medical experts that there was no known case of anyone's dying from this cause. There were many cases, however, where LSD had resulted in death from misperception of surroundings. For example, a person convinced he could fly, stepping out the window of a tall building. I thought of Barbara running through the traffic in downtown Honolulu. That she hadn't been killed was no fault of the family. The result, however, was that despite the best efforts of the LaBianca detectives, the DA's office had a very weak case. Pending trial, four of the five were released on bail. They immediately returned to the corner outside the Hall of Justice, where they would remain on and off during most of the remainder of the trial. Since Uish, who had given Barbara the LSD-laden hamburger, was nearly 9 months pregnant, Judge Choate released her on her own recognizance. She promptly fled the state. Nancy Pittman, who had been arrested with Davis, was freed on the forgery charge. She was rearrested a few weeks later while trying to pass Manson a tab of LSD in the visitor's room at the county jail. After serving 30 days, she was again freed to rejoin the group on the corner and subsequently to become involved in still another murder. December 21st, 1970, to January